Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What impact do the world's elderly have on the rest of the people on the planet? Thanks to extraordinary advances in medicine, average lifespans have grown by decades in many parts of the world, so that within about 20 years, an additional 216,000 people will celebrate their 65th birthdays every day. While few people would disagree that reaching old age beats the alternative, the unprecedented growth of the percentage of elderly members of the global population does present some unprecedented challenges as humans struggle to redefine the rights, roles, and responsibilities of the oldest among us. Author Ted C. Fishman explores these issues in his new book, Shock of Gray, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. He is in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tomorrow. Ted, welcome back to Think.
Oh, glad to be here. Really delighted.
What is old?
Old is depends on where you are. You know, if you ask Americans how old they are, they usually say they're around 15, how old they feel, they usually say they're around 15 years younger than they are. And if you ask Japanese people, they usually say they're around 10 years older than they are because they aspire to that kind of status. But if you ask Chinese people who are 50, are they old? They say yes, and they're really unhappy about it. So, you know, it's a fluid concept. But when we're talking about demographics, we're usually talking about what the big divides I see in the book are when things start happening to you because of your age. So when does the workforce start seeing you differently? When does your health change? When do you consider moving deeper into the workforce or receding into the workforce? For a lot of women, for example, as they reach what would be late career ages but they didn't work, they are newly entering the workforce. So there's something about their age that makes them more active participants in the workforce right now, which is a first in history.
Well, the workforce is really interesting. Let's talk first about retirement. At least in the West, we think of appropriate retirement age as being somewhere in the maybe mid to late 60s. Is that realistic if we can imagine that we might live into our 80s or 90s?
It may be realistic because the law makes it realistic, but it's not realistic in terms, I don't believe, in terms of people's aspirations or what a society needs in order to sustain itself. So as you mentioned in your introduction, I thought it was very good that we have to rethink what happens in a population that's older. The reason we have to rethink it is because lifespans are so much longer. So for 7,000 generations of humankind, people really haven't lived any longer than any of those other 7,000 generations. But in the last 10 generations, we're living a third longer and sometimes double the length of life. And when you think about what kind of country you want to be, what kind of person you want to be, what kind of family you want to be, I don't think people want to be idle for a third of their lifetime. And we certainly can't support people to be idle a third of their lifetime because it takes a third of a lifetime at the beginning of life to get ready for the rest of your life. So you can't have people working just a third of their lifetime, getting ready a third, and then being idle a third.
Now, there are also cultural differences in how we approach old age and whose job it is to take care of older people. I first want to talk about paid caretakers, because this is a big issue for people whose health, in many cases, has declined. Where do those workers come from?
Yeah, it depends where you are in the world. So in the United States, we have domestic care workers, and they generally come, if they're the one-to-one caregiver in a person's home, they tend to come from the lower end of the economic sphere. So low-wage workers, it always strikes me that the people who are most valuable in our lives, the ones who take care of our children and the ones who take care of our parents, are the ones we pay the least.
Yeah, what is up with that?
I don't know. Maybe it's just because so many people can step into the role and we allow people without training to step into that role. But, you know, there's a big shift in humanity that comes as society's age. So in big metropolitan areas in the United States, care workers often come from other areas of the world. They fill in for the workforce to do stoop labor that the locals won't do for that wage. You know, when people say that Americans don't want to do that work, usually what they mean is, or what they ought to mean is, Americans don't want to do that work for that wage.
Right.
So if you use Japan as a comparison, Japan has a very comprehensive network of caregivers and it's professionalized and they make a living wage, a good living wage. and they tend not to be the one-on-one caregivers we have here. So there's the person who comes in and is the overnight watcher or caregiver. There's the person who comes in the daytime. In the book, I profile a gentleman who is a professional bather, you know, and he's bathed 8,000 people in his career, and he's very good at it. And the baths are important everywhere, but they're particularly important in Japan. And then when you go to places that are ahead of us on the aging curve, you see very stark movements of people. So one of the countries I profile in Shock of Grey is Spain, which is a very interesting place, of course, for family life because family values are explicitly expressed when people talk about their children and themselves. They say that the family is the most important thing to them, and they are really vehement about it. But family sizes in Spain are small. Parents like their professional children to stay professional and not do this stoop work. So Spain, which was the sending country for the rest of Europe, which meant that the Spaniards played more or less the role that the Mexicans play in America. They filled the low-wage jobs in France and Germany. And around the year 2000, they went from being a relatively young country to being a very rapidly aging country. And Spain went from having almost no immigration at all in the year 2000, very, very small, less than 1% of Spain was foreign-born, to 8 years later having among the highest levels of immigration in the world, the same as the United States. And it was driven largely by this big hole in the workforce that that was needed both to fill the jobs that young people normally take, but also for the caregiving jobs. And this can change the demographic not just of your own country as you bring these other people in, but of other countries. So what happened in Spain was people from South America and from North Africa came, and Ecuadorians came in huge numbers to Spain. So Ecuador went from being a young country to being one of the biggest sending countries of immigrant workers.
And then who cares for Ecuador's old?
Exactly. So Ecuador went from being a young country to being an old country because one out of every eight people in Ecuador had migrated out of the country, mostly to serve in these care jobs. It's fascinating.
And then there is also the issue of other kinds of outsourced labor. When we look to the developing world, those are jobs mostly for younger workers.
Yes, and they become jobs mostly for younger workers. They're not destined. In fact, the reason I began writing the book, Chris, was because my research on China, which you and I have talked about before, in that research I noticed that I would get to these Chinese cities and they would be massive agglomerations of young people. Mm-hmm. You know, China had sent 150 million people out of the countryside into its cities. Most of them were under the age of 25. And I started thinking, where is the urban infrastructure coming to employ all these 150 million people? And it was $1 trillion to $2 trillion coming from aging countries, places in Europe, East Asia, North America, where the workforce was aging. And I started wondering, was globalization itself driven by the aging of the world's population? And China is exhibit A there. You get lots of money leaving expensive workplaces because elsewhere in East Asia, in Europe, in North America, healthcare benefits for an aging population are expensive. Social Security is expensive. Taxes are high. Employer costs are high. Capital has moved to the places that don't pay that. And they don't pay it for their younger workers. And China was willing to provide it. So you have this massive, unremitting form of age arbitrage or age discrimination, take your pick on the term. And in a nutshell, that's what globalization is.
We know that obviously the growth of cities has fueled a lot of economic growth in China. Talk about how the growth of cities is actually related to our longevity.
Yeah, cities are fascinating places. You know, for most of the history of mankind, cities were more dangerous to people than the countryside. They were less healthful. The water was worse. The air was worse. Sanitation was a problem. Cholera epidemics grew up in the cities, not in the countryside. But then around 1890, turn of the 20th century, cities switched from being dangerous places to being more healthful places. And they're more healthful for several reasons. One, public health came along and really changed the way people live. Take all the medicines you can think of, all of the health food diets you can think of, anything to promote your own health, nothing compares to public health. And the cities were the centers of public health. And then cities also get a literacy bonus. So when people are literate, they have access to health information. And If you look around a city, it is just one big billboard of health information. Even a bus sign that tells you to step up on the bus, or a subway sign that tells you to cross the gap, or look both ways before you cross. These are all healthcare informations, information on a gum wrapper, a cigarette wrapper, things that are on television where you watch a soap opera and the character is sick and you learn a little bit about those diseases. There's something about urban life that promotes health, and the literate people have the most direct access to it, and there's really good statistics on what literacy does, for example, to reduce child mortality, infant mortality. But if you have proximity to literate people, if you just live among them and you can talk to your neighbor who can read the labels and read the milk labels and read medical pamphlets, then you also get a bonus. So cities have been very, very helpful. And if you look at the cities in China, for example, urban children are around 40 pounds heavier than their rural counterparts. They're several inches taller, and they live longer. And you can see it when you walk around the streets. You can almost separate just on sight who's grown up in the city and who's come from the country.
So China also has an interesting, maybe it's out ahead of the world in that obviously its population growth is limited. Talk about the 4-2-1 problem.
Okay, so 4-2-1, that is the result of China's one-child policy. Mm-hmm. So around 1980, Deng Xiaoping looked around the whole of East Asia, and they said, wow, they have really small families, and they're so prosperous. He knew that prosperity drove down family size, but he wondered in his mind, could China escape all of the costs of supporting big families by limiting family size, and could we get a prosperity bonus once that happens? And his expectation was that instead of having the state paying for the food and education of families with 6 to 10 children, if family sizes were smaller, then parents could pay for the calories and education of those children. So they had the one-child policy. You know, a lot of people think it was to avert some Malthusian disaster where China couldn't feed itself. That wasn't the case. It was really an economic development program and a way to deliver the government out of the bind of paying for all of these costs for children. So he got his wish. He pushed through a policy that there would be one child per family. Family size shrank. Right now, the first generation of those children are now 30 years old, and they are having single children. Sometimes they can have two if they marry somebody who's also a single child. But it's completely changed the pyramid of the family. Mm-hmm. So as before, there were parents on top and several children on the bottom to support the family. Now there are four grandparents on top and two parents just below them and one child on the bottom. So it's kind of the one-child policy is also the six adults per child policy. And this has caused all kinds of distortion in China, particularly because the older people, often the parents and the grandparents, are completely excluded from China's economic miracle. And the children have to support them. And despite everything we think about Chinese filial values and filial loyalty, the demand on those children is so high that as often as not, they run away from the demand rather than embrace it. And it leaves a nation of uncared for older people.
I think that's a really fascinating phenomenon. And we're about to take a quick break here, but I want to talk more about that after the break. My guest this hour is author Ted Fishman. His new book is called Shock of Gray, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tomorrow. That event will take place at 11:30 at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. You can find more information at dfwworld.org. If you want to be part of our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Ted Fishman. His new book is called Shock of Gray. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tomorrow. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Ted, here in the U.S., we look at other cultures and we sort of marvel at how much respect they have for their elders and how they really do care for them. But you're finding that that's changing in places like Asia and Latin America that we would have assumed would never change.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, Americans are way better on the family closeness than we give ourselves credit for. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing the book, you know, I went all over the country to communities that are older, that are younger, that are challenged economically, that are prosperous. And I just find that the closeness in the American family is extraordinary. Even in the realms of society where the cartoon version of that ethnic group is of a family that's very broken, it tends to be very strong. So in African-American families, you know, I had the chance to talk to President Obama's doctor, who's an inner city doctor in Chicago, and he says that the lengths that African-American families go to support dependent elderly people is extraordinary. They really marshal everything that they can from their family. Part of it is because they distrust institutions, mm-hmm. their care. But the flip side of that is that often the places that we fantasize as having much, much stronger filial ties than we do are really kind of broken. So in the book, I went to Japan. I went to China, of course. I went to Southern Europe. These are all places where people always come up to you and say, "You Americans, you put your old people in nursing homes. We would never do that here." Well, a lot of times it's because labor is cheap in their countries and they don't need nursing homes. But it's also just not true. So the places that really insist on strong family values also insist that women do a lot of the heavy lifting to keep the family going. So an adult daughter has to take care of the parents, the older parents, they have to take care of the children, and the burden is very, very high. So when you get a mix of some level of emancipation, women can go to school, women can enter the job market, and there's some way to escape from that very, very heavy demand, women run to the door and take the out, sometimes because they want to and sometimes because they just need to. So if you're a woman in Japan or in Southern Europe and you're allowed to get educated, you are being educated at the university level. That takes you through your 20s. If you're getting a professional degree to your mid-20s, you invest in your career. That takes you to your late 20s. Your fertility window is shrinking. So there's a willingness and a kind of deep desire for women in these places to take the opportunity to achieve their aspirations. It's a fantastic, wonderful, good news story about an aging world. But they don't have time to get to more than three children, and sometimes they don't have time to get to two children. And then in places like China, where the children go far, far away from their families and to expensive cities, and their families are left on the low-cost countryside, you know, the kids find that, you know, after a few years, they have all kinds of reasons to spend their money on themselves and they don't send it home. Hmm. And really, some of the saddest situations for older people I saw were in these very traditional societies where the children are expected to take care of their elder relatives, but the demands are so high or perceived to be so high that they simply don't.
I think the most shocking country that I read about here was Japan, where people are living to just unbelievably long ages and they're healthy and they're doing great. And that seems like a benefit all around. But when it comes to remaining in the workforce or re-entering the workforce, they really get slapped in the face.
Yeah. Well, I think Japan teaches us a lot about our future, because they've aged ahead of us and they've already adapted to an aging society. So I was lucky enough to stay with a family that was a multi-generational family where they were taking care of some aging relatives in their house, and then also spend time at the factory where the family ran the show. And I sat in a conference room for a couple of weeks just interviewing one older worker after another. And these are guys, you know, strong, capable guys who in the United States would be long past their industrial used by date.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens in Japan is that the pension system isn't that generous unless you work for a great company like Toyota or one of the big companies. But for the vast number of workers there, it's not enough to make you through the ripe old age that Japanese get to. So you retire at 60. They give you a party, a cake, a watch. You go home. On day three of your retirement, you get a call you know, hello, would you like to work again? And the guy says, yeah, I really would, and I need to. I said, well, you can come back. You can have your old job and see all your old friends, and aren't we family? Come on, but you know what? We're going to pay you half your former salary. You're not going to get any benefits or health care. You know, the government pays for some of that, and you have your pension. And the older Japanese workers need to take this bargain, and they do take this bargain. Half of all retirees in Japan work, male retirees work, and they tend to work for around half their former salary. And this has huge impact on the life of the elderly in Japan, but it also impacts the young in Japan.
Who then are competing for the same jobs.
Yeah, so they're competing with guys who are willing to work for half their wage. Mm-hmm. And they aren't underwritten by their pension or by Social Security. And so you get an older class of workers, which is reduced to contract status or hourly wage status, and their status informs the terms that younger workers are hired on. So the younger workers in Japan have also had this big shift where now they're contingent workers, part-time, contract, temp workers, seasonal workers. And when you devalue your older people in society as workers, you devalue your young ones at the same time.
Do we do that here, though, too, Ted? I mean, we don't necessarily fire people and hire them back at half salary, but it's really hard for someone in their, even their late 50s, if they happen to be laid off, to find another job.
Chris, we do that. And that's one of the themes of the book, which is, you know, the biggest form of employment in the world right now is contingent employment. And mm-hmm. it has something to do with the aging of the world. So if you look at our official retirement ages, where people think hard about whether they should still work or not, 62, 65, it's above when people are actually losing their primary form of employment. Mm-hmm. People tend to be losing their primary employment in their 50s. And in industrial employment, it's in their early 50s. Part of it is because the global tides of money and production are moving away from those older workers and working hard to move away from those older workers. Sometimes the jobs move, but sometimes machines move in to replace them. And so right now, we have record high unemployment for older workers ever since the numbers were taken, and it's even higher than when general unemployment was higher than it is now in the Depression. And the period during which older workers look for new work is the longest of any age group, despite their experience mm-hmm. in the workforce. And when they do enter the workforce, 9 or 10 months on average after they start looking, they're coming in between 20% and 50%. At wages that are 20% to 50% less and without benefits. So there is this vast devaluing of the older worker in the United States and all throughout the industrial worker. Europe's even worse because you're not even allowed to re-enter the workforce after you lose your job in your 50s.
And that obviously makes it hard. You know, all those calculators that you do online to tell you whether or not you're saving enough for the time when you stop working, they never say, let's also calculate in case you become unemployed at 57.
Yeah, no. And I would say, like, one of the big messages of the book, and I hope it happens, is that you have to prepare for contingency late in life that you are now unprepared for, which is you're going to have to figure out how to work. And you might have to be figuring that out in your mid-50s and work until you're 70 or 72 or 75 or as long as you want or are able. And you need a cookie jar that you're shoving money into that next to the cookie jar that you're shoving money into for your children's education and your retirement. And the money out of that cookie jar has to be devoted to making you as valuable as you possibly can be in your 50s and early 60s so that when an employer looks at you, they don't say, oh, you're a fungible worker. You have experience, skill, judgment that's matched with your time in the workforce, and you're more valuable than you've ever been, not easily devalued. And we all owe it to ourselves to make ourselves into that kind of person. That means lifelong learning, training, and that's money. And we need to put money aside for that.
It also seems like it would be an interesting or rather a different situation for workers who are knowledge workers as opposed to those who work with their bodies. It's pretty hard to keep doing the same job at 72 if you've been working on your feet for the last 50 years.
Exactly so. And knowledge workers, you know, the kind of professionals who can't acquire what they know early in life. You know, architects are very valuable late in life mm-hmm. because to learn to build a skyscraper or develop a city is not something you can just come to in your 20s. You know, but some of the more toiling jobs that you mentioned, hard labor factory jobs, anybody at any age can do, and young people are more suited to. But this is shifting because there's all kinds of technological tools that can deliver people from the most physical job. And it's a great growth area for the economy, which is how do you shift the jobs that are filled with toil into jobs that are knowledge jobs or jobs that require less, punishing activity.
Ted Fishman is my guest. His new book is called Shock of Gray. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Diane in Sanger. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I am retired, and I worked for 51 years. So in order for that to be a third of my life, I would have to be 153.
May this be just a third of your life. Good for you.
So I find this rhetoric that I'm hearing now about cutting benefits for the elderly somewhat Orwellian, and I'm wondering what the book states as far as, is there some sort of stage, or do you state that people should take into account how many years a person has worked before they expect them to be to go back into a workforce? Or I'm curious what sort of stages you are suggesting for this.
Yeah, well, it's more art than science. Could I ask you how old you were when you retired?
66.
66?
Uh-huh.
So you began work when you were 16?
15.
Okay, so in a knowledge economy, we're often asking people to stay in school to their mid-20s or even early 30s, right? So for them to work the 51 years that you've worked, that would take them into their 80s. So it is rather fluid, and I do think we have to take this into account. One of the things about people who stay in school longer is that the public investment in them is also higher. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could, expect that the contribution to them be commensurate with the investment in them. But it is fluid. I think one of the things that people really want to do when they reach kind of their late career is they want to stay active and they want to contribute. What they don't want is for the terms to be set for them. And I think that's the Orwellian part that you're talking about, and I'm fearful of that too.
Talk for a minute, Ted, about the political and economic power that older people wield, at least in this country, because sometimes their priorities in terms of public spending are very different from maybe their children and grandchildren.
Yeah. So, we have a situation in the country right now where we're in fiscal crisis, and a lot of these are because of age-related expenses. And I think there's a mass confusion to what of these problems are caused by the aging of the population, what of them are just caused by the nature of the promises that were made to an older population, and what happens when those promises meet recessionary economics. And I think recessionary economics is a big part of it. But if you look at communities around the country, Chris, there is a big disparity in the way they deal with their public spending, depending on their demographic profile. So some of the communities that I profiled in Florida, for example, are among the stingiest in what they will spend per child on education, because the electoral clout of the older population there is very, very strong. And also the interests of the people who are committed to economic development down there have bet so heavily on seniors that they want to push services towards the seniors, and they don't feel it's as important to push them towards the children. So as the world ages, we face a situation where electorally you have competing populations, and that's in the title of the book, how the young are pitted against the old. But we also face a situation where we have to decide how we're going to triage resources. Mm-hmm. So we could spend everything we have on age-related expenses and spend very little on infrastructure and education, or we could figure out ways to pare back what we're spending on age-related expenses and still pay respectable amounts on infrastructure and education and everything else that society does. There's just not enough money in the entire world to keep all of the promises that we've made for ourselves. And I am not a libertarian or, a small government person. I am far from that. I believe in good government. And one of the things I've found in the book is that good government, whether it comes from the left or the right, is essential to the management of that, but it's good government that counts. So what you really need in an aging world is the moral leadership that says, what kind of country do you want to be? What kind of people do you want to be? Do you want an older population that feels engaged and participates? Or do you want one that is allowed to be idled and is expected to be idled?
What is the impact to the transfer of inherited wealth, of the reality that people live so much longer? Because, you know, if you in the past died with some resources at a relatively young age compared to lifespans now, there might be money for your heirs. And these days, if you're not working for 20 or 30 years, that money's often gone.
Well, for most people, it's not even an issue. You know, for 50% of Americans, they retire with less than $50,000 in savings at retirement.
So they're living on Social Security.
So they're living on Social Security. So, you know, the intergenerational transfer is a non-issue for them, except mm-hmm. perhaps their house. But there's a good chance they'll try and unlock the value of their house in order to pay them with a reverse mortgage
right.
or with a sale or something like that. But there is a very, very fascinating relationship if you compare countries where the older generation has most of the money and the younger generation doesn't with countries where the older generation has little and the younger generation has the money. So in Japan, you know, this is the perfect case where if you live in Tokyo and you're an older person, your house is accumulated, you know, to be 30 times the value of your lifetime earnings.
Wow.
And your children will never afford that house. So adult children tend to live with their parents because it's their only way to get that house, and they tend to be slaves to their parents. But in China, where the young group has taken advantage of all the economic growth and the older people are still pauperized, the old people try and move in with their kids, take care of their grandchildren in order to ingratiate themselves back into the family, and the power relationship is completely inversed.
Wow, what a fascinating dichotomy.
Yeah, I mean geography has something to do with it. If you compare mainland China to Hong Kong, for example, Hong Kong, the older generation is wealthier than the younger generation, but they also really live close to their kids, so they're bearing down on them all the time. And families are very close in Hong Kong because they only have a few square miles, and the kids can't run far away. But it's a different story when you can live 1,000 miles from your parents.
Ted Fishman is my guest. His new book is called Shock of Gray. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tomorrow. That'll take place at 11:30 at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. You can find information about the appearance at dfwworld.org. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Ted Fishman. His new book is called Shock of Gray, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. One of the things you discovered, you mentioned that age is relative at the top of the hour, and in fact, there's ageism even among the elderly. It's also relative depending on where you are geographically. And you compare in the book Sarasota, Florida, and Rockford, Illinois.
Yeah, well, there's ways in which the world can make your community feel young or old, and there's ways in which you in your community can make your community feel young or old. So in industrial America, which has been really hard hit by the movement of jobs, and you have high unemployment among older workers, those communities feel very old. And one of the places that I visited, because I was invited to visit it by the economic development people there, was Rockford, Illinois, which is a community that has about 140,000 workers, 65,000 of whom are identified as underemployed by local officials. And that's because the nature of their employment has changed as industries have moved jobs and automated.
It was a manufacturing center.
It was a very mighty, powerful manufacturing center, and it accounts for a lot of the city's charms. For most of the 20th century, it was one of the 25 richest towns in America, and they've got a symphony, they've got a repertory theater, they've got some nice museums, beautiful parks. There's a lot of beautiful assets there. But because the workers in the city have been devalued in this way, young people in Rockford don't want to stay there, and they leave, particularly the educated young people, and they flee mostly to Chicago, which is the beneficiary of the flight of young people from all over industrial America. Chicago's in a kind of renaissance because of all the young people who are fleeing their aging communities, aging because they're fleeing. So Rockford is a place where nearly everything in the atmosphere tells you you're old at 50. And it's the project of Rockford to try and rejuvenate itself, to create cafe society, theater groups, rock clubs, whatever it can to keep the young people there and recruit them home if they've moved away. Well, it hasn't been all that successful. It's a long-term process. They may get there. But right now, the place really mostly works to make you feel old. Demographically, it's very similar to another town that I looked at in the book, a place that is kind of a magic place for older people, maybe one of the best places to age in the world, and it's Sarasota, Florida. My parents spent some time there, so I was familiar with it. They also have it's not an industrial town. They don't have any core industries per se, but they also have an opera company, a symphony, great parks, great everything that the world's richest communities used to build for themselves. And the reason they have that is because it's a community that you can move to when you're in your mid-50s, 60s, 70s, and feel younger.
And you're the hip crowd.
And you're the hip 60. Crowd. Yeah. You're the active young person. Mm-hmm. If you're an active 60-year-old in Sarasota, people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s are looking at you and saying, oh, treating you like an adolescent. You know, like, slow down. You're making it hard for the rest of us. But the pressure and the supports for staying active there are so high, and people are so keen on being active that it's really a place that's found its rejuvenation in aging, which I think is fascinating. One of the statistics I love about Sarasota is that per capita it has the highest number of not-for-profit organizations in the country, because people come there and they want to re-engage. And they want to be social, and they want to have something to talk about with friends at dinner. And the architecture of the town, the social architecture of the town, is all around getting people together and getting them to be social. And this has a huge health and longevity benefit to people in Sarasota.
Is there, though, a bias against people who get into their upper 80s and early 90s and do become sick or feeble?
There's supports and there's a bias. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say in the old world that the biggest bias against people in a place like Sarasota is the gender bias, because women live longer than men, and they often spend down their money taking care of their sick husbands. So if you do pauperize yourself doing that as an older woman, you could end up very desperate, even in a town that values its older citizens. And that was quite sad to see. One of the places I visited in Sarasota was the former welfare home, which is the only place you can go in Sarasota if you have no money, but still need care. And the people who go there, they tend to enter around age 85. They stay for 3 years. The vast majority are women who once had means but spent them down caring for somebody.
Ted, will the Sarasotas of the world have to expand the labor force among older workers in order to remain prosperous?
You know, Sarasota is a great place to live, so people with money and people without money move there in late life. Mm-hmm. So when you visit the stores there, the workers, the shop boys, the clerks, the guys with brooms and pails, they're also, you know, past traditional retirement age. And when the local supermarket there chain puts a Help Wanted ad out, they get 500 senior citizens applying for each job.
Wow.
And when you go to Subway Sandwiches in Sarasota, you see like the young immigrants making sandwiches next to older people. And if you did that where I live, you'd think the older people own the store and the immigrants were the hires. But in Sarasota, it's the opposite. The immigrants own the store and the older people are the ones they've hired. You know, in these older communities, of course, there'll be very, very high demand for work among older people, because older people very often need work. The biggest fear in the world right now is that with this great gift of life comes the huge threat that you'll outlive your money. And if you can accumulate money rather than spend down, you make a big difference for yourself and for your economy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next on the phones to Betsy in Arlington. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thanks.
I'm really enjoying the program and listening to your guests talk about some of the things that happen to people that are getting older in the workforce. But I live in the Fort Worth area, and I saw the very same thing in the subway as you just described. So it's not just Sarasota that older people are trying to go back and take minimum wage. I was wondering if your speaker has any suggestions as to talking about pro-education, what might be a good thing for an older person to restudy or to a degree that might be, I mean, what suggestions would he have regarding education for the older person?
What makes sense there?
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course, the biggest thing to be smart on is the thing that you're already good at. You know, inevitably that's going to be changing. So just make sure your skills are fresh and that you're at the cutting edge of that and that you're learning how to manage change in that, because the young people that you're competing for don't have your life experience and they can't pour that into their management style. You can. So if you match your knowledge with your experience, that gives you a big advantage. And if you're turning towards something completely new, I don't really have any particular advice. I do believe that there is a generalizable advantage to studying whatever it is you're interested in, as long as you're studying. People who stay cognitively active are smarter about all of the things that they do, and there's lots of research to show this. And as long as you're engaged, there's one of my favorite studies in the book was this study about workers in their late 50s who were asked to do some sort of new computer learning, learn new software, learn new hardware. And the ones who had an expectation of retiring said, "Oh, I can't learn it. It's so hard. This is a young person's game." But the ones who were told, "If you learn this, you can stay in the workforce and you're apt to be promoted and everything," they said, "Wow, this is really interesting. This is fascinating. I'm loving learning it." So people who feel that they're winding down actually are cognitively slower than people who have the expectation that they can keep going.
Wow. We have an email here from Jessica who wants to know if your research found much about this trend, the idea that the older generation with means will relocate to the city or town where their adult children reside so that they can have more frequent contact with grandchildren or serve as a caretaker or be closer to family in case they need life assistance as they grow older.
Yeah, so this is a trend. So in the retirement communities, you do get this out-migration of people when they become dependent. It's a tricky, tricky operation, I think, because one of the very important things for happiness and for functioning in late life is your social network and familiarity where you are. So we're in this weird situation in America right now where the places that used to be the youngest places in America, American suburbs, new vibrant areas of metropolitan America, even here around Dallas-Fort Worth, that used to be the pictures of youth with kids all over, they are such wonderful places to live that people want to stay living there. So they used to be filled with kids and big families, and now they're filled with empty nesters. But people know their church members. They know their community organizations. They know their stores, and they get a lot of strength from the network that they're in. And then their kids come along and say, "Mom, Dad, if you come here, we'll work you into the new town that we live in, and we'll be near you." Well, it doesn't happen. You can't network a person late in life very easily into the network of the children. And they really, really lose a lot when they move to join their kids.
I don't mean for this to sound cold and calculating, but are there investment opportunities to be gleaned from the kind of research that you've done here?
I don't think that's so bleak. You know, I've written these two books on the rise of China and the aging of the world, which is the sum of all human fear. And whenever I give a talk on these things, somebody always rushes up and they go, "Oh my God, I'm shaking in my boots. How do I invest?" But of course, there's all kinds of ways to invest. Mm-hmm. I think the first thing to do is to invest in yourself. You can't match the income with investment that you would have by making more money. Right. Over your lifetime, right. than drawing down. The next thing is, you know, there's a whole universe of companies that are engaged in the aging world and adapting to it. There's new products that enable people. There's communities that are smarter about it. You can invest in the other way. If you think that aging communities are not so vibrant, you can focus your investment on the places that are really successful at attracting the young. Pick any scenario you think the future is likely to abide by, and there's an investment opportunity around it. But I will say that I do feel this general shift in the world that, you know, if the economic forces and the marketing forces once really focused on youth and everlasting youth in the youth market, there's a shift now to focusing on longevity.
Will, what accounts for this bias that we sort of younger people are thought to really not like older people, except their own older people? They love their parents and their grandparents. Why are people not able to extrapolate and think, well, the older people down the street are just as great as my family?
That's a puzzle, and I do comment on that. You know, if we have the sense of a continuity of a person's life or the narrative of a person's life, we have respect for that person. And we know the narrative of the lives of the elder people in our lives, but we don't know the narrative of the older strangers that we meet. And I think one of the challenges that we have for ourselves as society goes forward is that we have to understand the narrative in people's lives. So if you think about other groups that have been marginalized in America, you know, by race or class, we've gotten pretty good at expressing their narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And that's helped us be a multicultural society. If we get good at the narrative across generations, we'll be a much better multigenerational society.
Maybe some of that comes from older people remaining engaged in the workforce to tell their own story themselves.
That's absolutely it. That's absolutely it. And also when you're working with an older person, they have value to you maybe as a mentor mm-hmm. or a manager. They can bring their experience as a kind of treasure to you.
Has any of this research changed the kind of planning you're doing for your own old age?
Sure, and towards my mom
mm-hmm.
and towards my in-laws. It's changed it a lot. You know, I very, very much encourage them, actively encourage them to stay engaged in their communities.
How do they do that?
They're very active. My father-in-law at 83 was a former physics. He ran a big lab at MIT, and now he's teaching middle schoolers physics.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, running the kinds of experiments where things blow up in the hall and get get middle schoolers all excited. And he's really a kind of model on this.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom is the merry widow. You know, she's going to the opera and to theater all the time. She's moved from the suburbs to the middle of the city, downtown, to be where the action is. And she's really embraced every opportunity that comes her way. And I think about that too. You know, I used to think it'd be nice to retire somewhere else and go somewhere that was active. In the book, I talk about some nice places. But now I really think it's important to embed yourself even deeper and deeper into your own community and to stay where you are. Because if you've liked your life so far, chances are you're going to like it as you get older if you stay active there.
The new book by Ted Fishman is called Shock of Gray, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. He will speak tomorrow to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Ted, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.